So last week we looked at God the Creator, and if we're following the Catechism, it concludes that chapter by focusing on the human race and the condition in which we actually find ourselves. This is a most important topic for us to look at, and next week I'll have a look at Jesus and how he meets our need in this condition. The book of Genesis, as you probably know, contains two accounts of the creation of human beings from different periods of history, of their reflections on this fact. One account, Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, presents human beings, remarkably really and very poetically, but as a mixture of the dust, the earth, and the spirit. And the text is, God shaped Adam, and Adam in Hebrew means humanity. It's not initially a person's name, it's a human race. God shaped the human race from the soil, the Adama, and you can see the pun there, the Adam comes from the Adama, and that's not enough though. Breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. God's breath. God went, and Adam, or the human race, Adam and Eve obviously, breathed in and became a living being. There's another account. Speaks of human beings as being made in God's image. This is a later account from the priests post-exile. And it reads rather beautifully, God said, let us make Adam, human beings, humanity, in our own image and likeness. And God created human beings in his image. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful, increase, fill the earth and make it subject to you. And it was so. What's it mean to be made in the image of God? Well, I'll give you the benefit of scholars writing on it, and there are four different opinions. They could all be right. They're not fighting with each other, but these are different aspects that the Hebrew scriptures and then scholars looking at them see as this is how we're made in the image of God. Firstly, the fact that we can be in communion with God. Now, they had no firm opinion, I don't have a firm opinion, you probably don't either, about the different degrees of sensitivity of the animal world. And I don't want to rule that out or rule it in. Just, it's clear that human beings have got some special qualities, some special sensitivities, that we can consciously become aware of ourselves and what we're doing. We can examine it. We've got a thing called conscience, so we can actually do all this, and we can be aware of the pull, the attraction. You've made us for yourself, O God, said Augustine, and our hearts are restless till they rest in you. And that we can actually have communion with this God. So we're like God, just as a dogs can associate with other dogs, and horses with horses, and birds with birds. We can actually associate not only with each other, but with this mystery that we are calling God. So in that sense, we're like God. A second sense, and I'll come back to this a few times today and next week, we, like God, are able to give ourselves in love to others. And I think there we're getting really close to the essence, or one of the essences of who we are as human beings. We're capable of altruism. We're capable of love. We're capable of giving ourselves to another without wanting anything back. Now that, I'm not saying that's absent from the animal world. There would be examples which are pretty close to it, and I don't know enough about it for a start, but I don't want to go into it either. But we have this don't always exercise it, but this capacity to give ourselves in love, even when it's not apparently to our own benefit. Comes to mind, I might share it with you, on the 25th anniversary of my other brother, Jim, one of my other brothers, who was a priest ahead of me, 10 years older. They were celebrating the 25th anniversary in Papua New Guinea, because he and three others of his year were missionaries in Papua New Guinea for all their missionary life. And this was the 25th anniversary, and I may have told you this before, and I heard it on a tape that someone sent down to me. It's going back quite a while now. And on the tape, there was this man coming from a little place called Kelelogia on the Normanby Island on the D'Entrecasteaux group just off Milne Bay. And he said this, and I hope it's apparent to you the meaning. He said, "Oh, when you came to my village," he said, "I lived in a house with very small windows." If I may say in brackets, fear dominated their lives. Fear of the night, fear of the spirits, fear of the people across the valley on the next hill, whom they warred with. And, you know, it even goes back to cannibalism and things. So they lived in this, he said, "Now," he said, "I live in a house with big open windows." Which was his way of saying, which you've picked up, the missionaries, in this case it was my brother, but the missionaries brought them something that wasn't part of their cultural psyche. And probably necessarily not. To live, they had to, if I gave you something, you've got to give me something back. I mean, I've got to survive too. So it's a quid pro quo, as we say, an agreement. Because we can't afford to just give without receiving. So they didn't have that concept of just giving. And through the missionaries and Jesus. So here, back into the Old Testament, we, like God, are capable of giving ourselves to others in love. What an extraordinary thing. And the whole creation is a gift from God. We can give gifts like that too. In that sense, in the third sense, as male and female, which the text says quite explicitly, we're able to be God's instruments in giving life to others. We can be co-creators of life, just as God created Adam and Eve, man, woman. So man and woman together have this extraordinary capacity to actually create, to give life, new life. And fourthly, we're able to be God's instruments in carrying on God's creative action, bringing order into chaos. The basic image of the book of Genesis is, and it's taken from the Near East or Middle East mythology, is that there's chaos, there's swirling waters and the darkness. You know, in the beginning, hovering over the darkness of the swirling waters of the salt water and the fresh water fighting, God came, and creation was not making things out of nothing, it was actually ordering, bringing order, and God saying, "Okay, the sea, you've got to stop there." And the mountains are there, and God organized it so that there was order. And we have to do that too. Not dominate the world, but order the world. And where there is chaos, bring our intelligence to bear. And we've done this often very well, often terribly badly, to bring order into this world. So they are two images for creation that we find in the Genesis account. One, we are a mixture of dust, the earth, and spirit, the divine spirit, this tension that we have in ourselves and this complementary capacity we have as human beings. And the other, we're made in God's image in a number of ways, and you may even be able to add out some of your own. However, for all its inspired beauty, and it is a beautiful account, as long as you don't take it as science, it's a beautiful poem about the way we actually experience ourselves, the portrayal of human beings offered to us in the book of Genesis is necessarily imperfect. And now, very briefly, heck, it has to be brief, I want to take you, I offered you, or John gave it to me and I gave it to the rest of you, that article from the tablet by Father Jack Marney on many things, but it also included how do we re-look at all this in the light of evolution? And if evolution is something that you're at home with and think is the more likely, in light of what evidence we've got, scenario for us, well then, we developed from the other forms of life. And in that evolutionary perspective, we have to re-look at everything in the book of Genesis for a start. And I'll do some of this a bit later. But the key thing I want to bring out for you at the beginning is, when we look at our world, we look at the animal world, let's stay pretty close to where we are, we see what they call the survival of the fittest, don't we? We see the top dog, we see the gorilla that actually is the main male, and you've got to, when he gets a bit sick, another one takes over from him and so on. But you've got this power is important, and we've got the female of the species being very careful to select the strongest male. She doesn't know, she's doing instinct to make sure that her progeny are the healthiest possible. This is all obvious stuff, and you pardon me skimming over the surface because I'm no expert in any of this. But we've got this instinct, you see, in the animal world. We've got it too, but we see it in the animal world very clear, this fight or flight thing, and how one species has to protect itself against a more dominant predator. And you see them there, and then the birds making certain sounds when a possible predator enters the forest, and you can hear them warning each other of this. That's herd instinct, or whatever you're going to call it. But we've also got the mating instincts. But say, take bees, for example. It's quite dreadful, really, the way they behave. But you see the reasons for it. And the male, of course, the drones, their only purpose is to impregnate the queen bee. So when the time comes, the queen bee, as you probably know, flies high, and only the strongest drone can reach her to impregnate her up there somewhere. The rest, the whole meaning of their life is collapsed because the strongest one has done it. And then, of course, he dies doing it. And then when they come down, when winter comes, sorry to tell you all about the bees, but you might as well hear about it. When winter comes, they have this wax, you know, to keep the place kind of warm as possible. That it keeps the same temperature all the year round. All the males are kicked out of the nest, dying in the cold. They're no use anymore. And then they make a certain number of them by the size of the... I can tell you why I know all about bees, but anyhow. They determine by the width of the little cell, because when the queen bee comes in, if she's squeezed, it's going to be female. If she's not squeezed, it's male. So there's a certain number of male ones that are there for the one purpose only. Then they're kicked out in the winter. Thank God human beings don't do that, or we'd all be all women here, and I couldn't be. But these are all with a view to survival of the group, of survival of the etc. We've got all of these things too. But we've got something else quite extraordinary that we've touched on, and that is, we've got, so therefore, in a sense, sin, we'll call it sin for a moment, doesn't need explaining. The fact that human beings behave badly to each other is what you'd expect, granted our origins, where we come from. It's kind of to be expected. The herd instinct, one tribe fighting another tribe, fear of the unknown, flight, fight, all this stuff that we're still seeing all over the world. But we're seeing something else that does need explaining. And that is this altruism, this capacity of the human being to just love, to give, and not to for one's own benefit particularly, but just to meet the needs of the sick and the poor and the broken. And some tribal groups still, nomadic groups, the old and the vulnerable young are just left to die in the open. Because they have to move on, they have to survive as a group, so they can't afford to stay back looking after them. But we've learned to look after each other. We've learned to give each other in love. We've learned this extraordinary thing that we've got as part of the evolutionary process, but it needs explaining, and it takes us actually eventually to God and to Jesus, which I'm going to spend next week on. As Jesus himself said, no one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. And we think of grandparents, we think of parents, we think of nurses, we think of doctors, and we think of the Médecins Sans Frontières, we think of United Nations. I mean, our world is full of people actually giving their life. Giving their life. What are they getting out of it? Something profound, of course, but they're giving their life to others in love. Something that is humanly possible, but quite stunning in its what it means. So those who experience Jesus, and I won't stay with him because that's next week's topic, but I'll touch on it now. Those who experience Jesus tell us to look at him if we want to see how human God wants human beings to be. Adam, if you like, Adam and Eve, though if you're evolutionary, it's much more likely we had human beings emerging at different times. They call it polygenism. It's highly unlikely that we had one couple who started off the human race. Some emerged here, some emerged there, some emerged there, and we've all, whatever. It's very complicated material. But if you're into the evolutionary study, you'd be aware that, and theologically it's quite acceptable, even though Pius XII didn't allow it. I mean, we've got limits on our mind, even if we're a pope. But so we learnt the New Testament has this stunning thing that, no, if you want to see what a human being should be like, don't look at Adam, don't look at our ancestors, look at Jesus. He'll show us what we're capable of, what it is to be human, and he'll show it in a beautiful way. Here's Paul, Romans 5:12. Adam is the type of the one who is to come. And in 1 Corinthians 15:45, the first human being, Adam, became a living being. We read that in Genesis 2:7. The last Adam, Jesus, became a life-giving spirit. Not just living, but life-giving, which is what we're all capable of. Thanks be to God, and we see it all in Jesus. With that introduction, and that's all that is, what is this thing we call original sin? I think a better word for it, one I've been using myself for years, but is original sin is the sin of our origins. If I could say it before I look at that. The word for sin means missing the mark. Don't put any great moral stuff on it yet. Sometimes I miss the mark when I could have hit it. And I miss it because of pride, covetousness, lust, anger, gluttony, envy and sloth. They're the traditional seven founts of evil. You could have your own list just as good as that and probably better in the light of psychology. But basically sin is missing the mark. Even if I don't intend to, I can hurt you. I'm sure I've hurt people. I mean, I know I've hurt people. But I didn't intend to, you know, but you find you did. And parents do their best, but they probably look back and think, oh, God, I didn't do much. I don't know what. My parents looked at me and probably thought, oh, well. Anyhow, you know, you do your best, but you're not perfect. So we hurt our children and we hurt each other and couples hurt each other. You know all this. Priests hurt the people and people hurt the priests and so on. So it's sin's the kind of normal thing in a way. But we keep missing the mark. But thank God there's a possibility in us, which is very demanding, the inner journey of purification, and it's all a gift from God. It's possible for us to actually become like God, to become lovers, life givers, the way God is. To become like Jesus. So we say it's no longer I, the ego, it's Christ living in me. Well, original sin is the sin of my origins. It means, basically, the origins I come from, and you don't have to go back to the chimpanzees or the gorillas or whatever the more likely strand is. You don't have to go back there. You go back to my grandparents and my great-grandparents. It all affects us, doesn't it? The sins of the past become a pollution in the air, and we breathe it in. So if my father, he wasn't, thank God, if my father was alcoholic and didn't control it well and didn't understand it well and therefore was violent and whatever else happens, I'm a little kid, so I'm scared and I work out all these processes of defending myself, and they're not very functional often. you follow what I'm trying to get at. So I'm affected by my parents. I'm affected by the politicians of the day. I'm affected by the environment in which I am and which I breathe. Original sin is a way of talking about sometimes I miss the mark and it's my fault. I'm responsible for it because I choose to do this because I want to get this or get that or I want to hurt you or whatever. That's clearly personal sin. We're aware of that. And we do some of that. But the bulk of sin that goes on in the world isn't like that. It's actually the starvation of the spirit that comes from the hereditary and environmental factors. And original sin is talking about that. The sins of our origins. Sin is only used there by analogy. It's not the same word. It means missing the mark because I never found out how to do it. My father wasn't a good image to me, let's say, and I marry and become a father, and I've only got that kind of image, so I end up not being a terribly good father or husband or wife or mother or... Well, I said enough. So original sin is a way of talking about human missing of the mark that comes from my inheritance, my origins, and from the environment in which I'm born and brought up and schooled and so on. So, life as we experience it is far from perfect. How God intends us to be, how we are coming from God's hand, God's loving design, is one thing. How we find ourselves in fact to be is another. The difference is brought about by this thing we call sin. There's personal sin when we choose to act in ways that we know to be harmful to others and to ourselves. But here, in this lecture, I'm restricting myself to comments on this original sin, which refers to the influence that incline us to personal sin, influences that we've inherited from our origins. Now, the discovery of the library of Ashurbanipal of Nineveh in 1853, the publication in 1876 of the Chaldean account of the primitive myths, and the discoveries at Ugarit in the 1920s have helped us see that in presenting the primeval narratives, the inspired authors of Genesis is selecting from common Semitic mythology, but reshaping that mythology to highlight the theological perspective that he wishes to establish for his work. It's actually brilliant literature, but of course limited by the perspective of the day. But he's actually seeing how do we look at these myths that we're inherited, how do we look at them all from a perspective of an Israelite who believes in Yahweh. He does this to link what is common to mankind to the tradition of Israel, and also as a reminder to the king of the foundations of his rule, thus providing a critique of the king's way of exercising his reign. The Catechism's treatment of the fall and original sin, if I may dare to say so, is among its least satisfactory sections. So what you're hearing from me now is not what you'll find in the Catechism, basically. Everything else is, I think, but on this issue, it's not. In the New Catechism, an analysis and commentary published by the Catholic Institute of Sydney in 1994, Father Joseph Sobb, SJ, quotes the number of the Catechism. And he says, it's number 390, "The account of the fall in Genesis 3 uses figurative language." This is the quote. "But it affirms a primeval event," says the Catechism. A primeval event. Something that actually happened in history, beginning of history. "A deed that took place at the beginning of the history of man. It may be more accurate," says Sobb, "it may be more accurate and more authentically in keeping with the literary form to say that this narrative is affirming a primeval truth about humanity rather than describing a primeval event. So it's got, like all poetry or drama or myth, it's saying something really, really, really important about the human condition, but it's not describing an event, even though the Catechism presents it as an event. It doesn't argue it, it just takes it for granted it's an event. You may prefer to stay with the Catechism, by all means. On page 20 of the same book that I've just referred to, Father David Coffey, who was the teacher of dogmatic theology at Manly for many years, speaking more generally of the Catechism, writes, "It's not difficult to identify the mentality of the Catechism. It is that of the late Roman theology manuals of the 1950s, exactly what I was taught. I was ordained in 1961, and the theology I learnt was exactly what he's talking about. And it was handed on from one book to another book to another book to another book, and it was really basically, it had stagnated in a way. We had a good teacher of theology and all that, but the books and the stuff we learnt in the late, prior to the Vatican II I'm talking about, were this kind of stuff. Complete with their tendency to integralism, their lack of historical awareness, and their hermeneutical naivety."
Can we have that page?
Oh. Oh, thank you. Thank you, David. Their hermeneutical naivety means, well, understandably, it's only in the last 100 years and less, basically, that we've managed to get to understand the way the Bible's written and what those early... I mean, I grew up thinking Adam and Eve were two people, didn't you? And we were taught that by the priests and the nuns and everything, so I just took it for granted. Adam was a bloke and Eve was a girl and a woman, and that was how we began. But you can't say that today, for heaven's sake. We now see all this other literature, I referred some of it to you, from the ancient Near East, and it's a myth. But it's a myth that presents extraordinarily important truths, as long as we don't take them as factual data. The Catechism's treatment of the fall is an example of this last tendency, this hermeneutical naivety. And I'll talk about the fall in the second part of today's talk. Now, look at the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis. I've done this in great detail in other places, and it's on the web if you want it. The author of Genesis is not recording history prior to Abraham. No scripture scholar would disagree with that. So I'm not branching out here. I'm just giving you the fruit of universal consensus of anyone, Jewish, Catholic, non-Catholic, whatever, who's ever looked at the stuff, all would agree with this. The first 11 chapters, it's not recording history prior to Abraham. The author is looking beyond history to assert what is the unchangeable reality that underlies the history that begins with the stories of the patriarchs, chapter 12, Abraham. And even that's like talking about King Arthur, like it's well before history, but it's starting into get into the meaning of history and where the migrations occurred from and so on. The author is interested in his present reality and what it means to be human, caught between sin and the constant reality of God's relationship to us and our relationship to God. As we read the narrative of the sin of our origins, the correct question to ask is not, what's the meaning of these past events to us today? Adam and Eve did this, how has it affected me? That's the wrong question. The right question is, what is the inspired author saying about the human condition? That's the right question. What's he saying about his experience of life and people and history and the events of his people? He wants to bring out the limits within which he and his contemporaries must live. If they don't, like those who have gone before them, they'll suffer the consequences of a breakdown of law and order. He wants to show that we can learn from the mistakes of our ancestors. Yahweh is the God who hears the cry of the poor. Because of the mercy of God, the effects of our sin, and they're seen as punishment by the author of the book of Genesis, can lead us to a change of behaviour and to find forgiveness and new life. We don't have to be locked into always missing the mark. We don't have to stay captive from our primitive instincts, which we inherited from our forebears. We're able to actually, we can even learn to really, really love. However, as the author says, we can't go on sinning without suffering the consequences of sin. If we behave dysfunctionally, it'll have dysfunctional results for us. Though the author borrows from Semitic mythology, he's not interested in myth or its cultic expression. Rather, he's interested in history and therefore in human behaviour and responsible action, here formalised in a description of the human being as such, Adam, and the various basic relationships within which we work out our lives. Not all our inclinations are towards good. In the story of the flood, God looks at our behaviour, and the main sin, by the way, that brought on the flood, and that's part of the myth, there's floods all over the place, but that's not what this is about. This is about a collapse of the whole system that God created. You know, it just, God built up to human beings, then human beings behave badly and everything it unbuilds till finally the whole cosmos that they knew collapsed. Because the flood, as you know, didn't come from rivers or seas. It came from the heavens. It was God letting the waters above crash down and join the waters beneath. And you're right back to chapter one, salt and fresh water, chaos again. Except there was one person who, the power of one, Noah, who believed. And because one person believed and trusted, life went on. Had there been none, would have been a reversal to chaos, as the author understands it. So God says, he looks and he says, God regretted that he made us. In the cute little story there, God's up there saying, oh God, I made a blue this time, I shouldn't have done it. Well, I'm going to wipe them all out. And then Noah's there and he thinks, oh. So he gets Noah to make a boat. It's not a boat, it's a temple. It's the shape of a temple. And it rises above the chaos, so that all light and all life comes out of that place. And that's where life still comes from the sacred place, the temple. Temple of our body, the temple of the world. Yahweh is intimately involved in the human history, and divine mercy is much more stronger than our sin. And that's put in cute ways too. Remember when Adam and Eve sinned and they're naked and they're hiding, and God comes along and says, where are you? And they said, we're trying to hide from God. And God says, and then what does God do? This is rather cute. God sits down and sews for them, because the fig leaf doesn't cover a lot. God actually sews for them a little lap thing to make them more. And I mean, you think of God up there, you know, with a little machine, I suppose. I don't know what he is. But it's a cute story, but it's about saying, hang on, sin's dreadful, but missing the mark is dreadful, but stop worrying about missing it, start to hit it. I mean, you can actually, there's something around that'll help you hit it, and that's what we're on about. So in Genesis 2 and 3, he speaks of the paradox of being human. Now, check it, see if it's real for you. It is for me. Where the dust and the spirit, there's part of us that belongs to the clay and the earth and the snake and the animal world, let's put it. But there's also this other extraordinary thing we've got, which is this spirit thing. Sanctity and sin. The wonder and limitations of being human. And this is followed by a section in which, chapter 4, the author, the theologian who wrote it, reflects on the disharmony that we humans experience. Pain, sweated labour. Why is it so hard to, if you're in that country you'd know, I guess, but why is it so hard to try in the rocks and sand of Judea to get vegetables going? It's not easy to do. It wasn't easy then and it isn't easy now. Why is it so hard to do these normal things? Why is sex so hard? Why has a woman got to have such pain giving birth? You'd think it'd be a natural, wonderful thing, but it's painful. Why? And they put all that down to sin, you see. having broken your connection with God, having disobeyed God, then this has the effect on that. What about Adam and Cain and Abel? Why are the pastoralists, and they were doing it all around the place, and the farmers fighting over the wells? Why can't we share water? Still going on, isn't it, in that part of the world? But why? Cain represents the city. Cain means smith, smithy. And Abel is the word in Hebrew for hebel, means just a puff, a breath. The psalm says, what are we human beings? We're only a passing breath. We're here so little, and there's so much pain and suffering. And it depends on the person, of course, but all that. And so what happens? Abel only appears for a few verses and then he's gone. And the city finally beats the country because it's got the power of the city and organisation. Why is all this fighting going on? Experience of the absence of God, of suffering and guilt. They're all the results of human disobedience, says our author. Our failure to listen to the inspiration of God's Spirit. God is inspiring us, we know that, to be beautiful, to be loving, to be self-giving. But there's a lot of weight that we're carrying and we're not doing it too well. The description of paradise, you get the impression, even from the catechism, but you get the impression that, and you may have had this already, I did when I was younger, a lot younger, that we, first of all, we began in a paradise. Like it was all absolutely beautiful. Then we did sin and then we were kicked out of paradise. You know the story? As though they were stages in the human development. Well, that doesn't make any sense for a start. We're actually, believe it or not, improving. Keep working at it. We started very primitive. There never was a paradise. Paradise is a description of what would be like if. In other words, God couldn't surely intend all this violence and pettiness and sin, missing the mark. That can't be what God wants. So paradise is a description of what the world would be like if there was no sin, if we stopped sinning. And then there's possibilities for that. That's what it is, not a stage of our development. The tree of life in the story is a symbol of immortality. There were two trees in the garden in the book of Genesis. He was a much wiser theologian than the people who taught us. There are two trees there. One, immortality, in all the myths and Greek stuff too, you know, the tree and all that, tree of life. And no one ever went near the immortal tree. No one did. God stopped them because when Adam and Eve snatched the fruit from the tree of knowledge of evil and evil, God said, oh God, if we don't stop them now, they'll go and get the other fruit and they'll live forever. So we've got to stop that. So he kicked them out and put a cherub there at the thing with the sword, lightning striking, to keep them out in the story. And we got the idea that death, that is death, physical death, was the result of sin. Well, give us a break. Physical death happens because we're material and we just run out of gas and we die. And it was always that way, had always been that way, and will always be that way. The religious truths we're talking about have nothing to do with physical death. They've got to do with communion with God, who's the source of life. The tree of life is a symbol of immortality. According to the myth, if we could eat the fruit of this tree, something that Adam and Eve never do, we'd live forever. The other tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the garden, symbolises wisdom. If we could eat this tree, this is the problem as they theologised about it, we'd be able to decide for ourselves what is good and evil. Why can't we decide? Why have we got to listen to God? Why have we got to submit? Why have we got to be sensitive to some mysterious divine presence inspiring us? Why can't I take control? Why can't I do what I want to do? Why can't the ego run the world? Are you with me? So we decide what's good. I'll decide what's good and evil. I'll do it because I can. Well, the world's full of that ego stuff, which is dreadful. Adam and Eve reach up and grasp the fruit. They didn't have to grasp it. It was there for them. They had to wait for it to fall. And remember the temptation, you'll be like God? The snake. It's not the devil, for God's sake. It's a snake. Read it. And the snake is all there down with the dust. The snake is a good symbol for the dust part of it. It's that part of me and the part of you and the part of everyone we know which is actually not open to the Spirit, not letting it be transformed by grace and love and inspiration and the divine presence. So you got that there, saying you can be like God. But God, we just read it, God wanted us to be like God. But we have to receive it as a gift, as a grace, not something we can control and grasp. And do you remember that beautiful poem about Jesus in the New Testament, Philippians, how it said, Jesus, being in the form of God, did not grasp equality with God, but he humbled himself. That's the very thing Jesus didn't do, was grasp. He received. He let it come as a gift and opened himself to it. But he never, ever tried to be equal with God. But we'll come to Jesus next week, please God. True wisdom can be received only from God. This is the truth that the author is telling us, and I think we'd all agree with it. God knows what is good for us. It's God who warns us that certain kinds of behavior are obstructive. Here's the Genesis account. Yahweh God commanded mankind, you and me included, from all the trees of the garden you may eat, but you may not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. For on the day you eat from it, you will die. Read it carefully. On the day you eat of it, you will die. That was the threat. The snake, that part of me that's not open to the mystery, said, I don't think so. I reckon I can take control of this. I can actually run my own life. Who am I to be pussyfooting around with all this? So I reach up and grab the fruit. Did Adam and Eve die on the day they did it? No. God is actually quite a softy. God, the human beings. God actually not only sowed them their little lap, but God kind of organized for them and kind of, you know, they couldn't stay in paradise, but they could still, and they went on. So God was saying, don't eat that fruit because it's poisonous. It'll kill you. God wasn't threatening people who would have lived forever to die. No one lives forever. None of the animal world do, and we're part of it. Death is normal, natural, part of the organic business of being a human being. That wasn't the threat. It was saying, look, don't do that because it'll kill you. If you try and reach up and grab the fruit and be the source of your own knowledge of good and evil, you'll muck up your life entirely and you'll ruin your communion with reality, with God, with everything. You'll kill yourself if you do it. And that's what we do when we sin gravely. The only life we have is a life received from love. If we choose not to obey God, and if we think we can decide for ourselves what is good for us, then we throw away our lives. That may interest you. That's a painting of sorts. It's a representation of paradise from the Temple of Mari from the 17th century BC. Well before the war. The Genesis account was probably written in the 5th century BC. Here we are 1,200 years earlier. And there's the thing. Notice, if I can do it for you. Yeah, where am I? Oh, is it? Don't know what's happening. Oh, there it is. It's not easy to see, is it? That's a cherub, the animals that are protecting the temenos, the holy place. See it? Oh. See those winged creatures there? They're symbols of, and you see them in all the Iranian places. They've got the wings of an eagle, flight. They've got the face of a human being, intelligence. They've got the body of an ox, fertility. And they've got the legs, etc., of a lion and the claws. So they've got all the power of nature. And they're there to tell you, they're there at the gate, at the door of the temenos, the whole sanctuary. If you, from Greece or somewhere, dare to come into our temple, the whole, you'll be destroyed. That's what it's frightening you out of doing. Well, there they are there, and they're there in the garden story too. Here is, there it is. There's the two trees, by the way. Here. There's the goddess, though she's a bit hidden, I think, which is the goddess. They're the four rivers. You know, Genesis has four rivers, north, south, east and west, coming out of the Garden of Eden. There they are there as well. And there's the goddess there with her foot on the lion, the female goddess, controlling the powers of the earth. And the rest of it, I mean, I'm giving you too much and too little. But I'm just trying to give you a quick look. There's plenty of that around. Of the story from the book of Genesis is common story, but with an incredibly intelligent, thoughtful, inspired angle on the mythology. Paradise is a poetic description of what God wants for us human beings and what would be if we didn't sin. The book of Revelation, by the way, in the New Testament, which is the last book in our the way we've got it, Genesis, the beginning, it actually ends with a paradise, doesn't it? A meal where it's a marriage banquet, wedding banquet, and the wine is flowing and it's all absolutely glorious. It's showing you, it's actually the Genesis story reshaped. This is what God wants us, our life to be like, so work at it, do it. Welcome grace. The tree of life is a symbol of immortality, I've done that. And the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We fail to listen and we give in to desire that is not in accordance with our deepest needs. I read to you, the snake was the most shrewd of all the living things in the field. The word for shrewd in Hebrew is arum. I'm giving you that for a reason. And this snake asked the woman, did God really say that you were not to eat from any of the trees of the garden? You will not die. God knows that on the day you eat it, your eyes will be opened and you'll be as gods, knowing good and evil. A temptation we're all still suffering from. And the woman saw that the tree was good to eat and pleasant to look at and desirable, so as to become wise, clever. So she took some of the fruit and ate it, gave it to her husband. I don't know whether this is typical or not, but to save a fight, the husband just ate it. And the eyes of both were opened, and what did they realize? They were arum. Arum was the snake, and they are arum. Playing on words all the way through this. To listen to the serpent, this is for you and me, obviously, to listen to the snake, the serpent, is to listen to that part of us, excuse me, that belongs to the dust. What we should be doing is listening to that part of us breathed into us from God, the Spirit. To follow the serpent is to follow our desires without discernment. She didn't discern. She saw that it was good to eat, and pleasant to look at and desirable. But that's not enough. Is it good? Is it really good for me, for you, for us, for the human species? Man and woman reach up to grasp the fruit. We want to be like God. Now this is exactly what God wants of us, to be in his image and likeness. But we can be like God only if we wait for and welcome grace. And here's the Philippians text I was referring to. Let that same mind be in you that was in Christ. Who being in the form of God, we're all in the form of God, by the way. It's exactly what the Genesis is telling us. He didn't regard equality as God as something to be grasped. He emptied himself, gave himself, taking the form of a slave. The author of Genesis goes on to reflect on the elements of the human condition, portraying them as a consequence of sin. the abuse of our God-given freedom, our wanting to be independent. And as far as it goes, it's quite a good theology, of course, falls short of Jesus. The most radical effect of sin is death, not in the sense of being mortal. The couple didn't eat the fruit of the tree of life, but in the radical sense of being separated from God, the source of life. And in all the New Testament too, death has two meanings. You've got to watch for it. One means physical death, which is natural. The other is real death, which is not being in communion with the source of life, who is God. Prior to any awareness of an afterlife, physical death was understood in the Old Testament as involving a final separation from the divine spirit, and that's where the problem lay. It's understandable, therefore, that physical death was sometimes caught up in this thinking and was thought of as being a punishment for sin. The author speaks also of the struggle between some of the animal and human world, and the struggle we experience in caring for the soil and gaining a living from it. He speaks of our inability to directly experience God, and our relationship with God as ambivalent. Furthermore, all is not right between the sexes, and having broken communion with God, we humans break the communion we have with each other. It's a highly developed theology, and quite a good one. There's violence between farmers and pastoralists, and violence would lead to the destruction of God's creation were it not for those like Adam, who they've always been there, who welcome God's grace. Like Noah, sorry, who welcome God's grace. Neat, I like the look of that. And I'll just do my best. You can now chat among yourselves. I think something seems to have gone wrong here, but that's the end of the first session, so it's time for morning tea.
I think Father just wants you to respond to that before it'll allow you to do anything else. So just say no.
Just do no. Yeah, no.
Now you can stop.